WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Two bombings shook the Turkish cities of Ankara and Istanbul yesterday. The blast in Ankara, just outside the hotel where President Bush is scheduled to stay on Saturday. Bush then travels to Istanbul, the host city, for the NATO summit next week. The Turkish government is offering reassurances that in spite of the recent violence, security is sufficiently strong and the country is secure. Turkey is often held up as the shining example of a democratic Muslim country, but balancing political pressure in Turkey has never been easy to manage between Western secularism and Islamic fundamentalism. For the US, Turkey has been a key ally in the war with Iraq. Now some are suggesting that this relationship may be more strained because of the Kurdish question in northern Iraq. Tonight on Point, the US, Turkey and their future together or not. We begin in Istanbul, host city for next week's NATO summit, where security has been an even greater priority in the run-up to the meeting. Johnny Diamond is Istanbul correspondent for the BBC. I asked him to describe the mood in the city now.
I think it's pretty mixed. I mean, I suspect in a city of 14 million people, there's probably a good 6 million who don't even know the summit is happening. But amongst those who do in central Istanbul, amongst the authorities, amongst the security forces, I think jittery is the best word to describe the mood. There are an awful lot of rumours swooshing around the whole area. There are stories about suspicious parcels, about cars filled with explosives at the airport. Nearly all of these, I should say, are untrue. But it gives you an indication of the kind of thing which people feel, and that is really that the attacks, the bombings of the last day, and the last few weeks, really, because there's been really quite a large increase in the number of attacks, pretty small ones, most of them, are only the beginning, and that more attacks will come.
Because I would imagine that security had been heightened anyway ahead of this NATO summit. Has it been even further so?
It's difficult to tell whether it's been increased since the bombings in Ankara and Istanbul on Thursday. I have to say, I mean, I've just been driving around the city and there are astonishing numbers of police around. I mean, there are always a pretty large number of police to be called upon. It's a fairly large security apparatus here. But really, everywhere you go in the centre of Istanbul, I'd say an area, 5 kilometres square, has police on it, and sort of groups of police as well, 10, 15, 20 of them standing around on street corners, sitting on benches. It's an astonishing sight. And then there are more helicopters in the sky than you normally see. There is a warship going up and down the Bosphorus, the stretch of water that divides European and Asian Istanbul. It really is very tight indeed. The question is whether high-profile security is the same as effective security. There was a summit here a couple of weeks ago that wasn't half as serious as NATO, but it was still something which Turkey wanted to make sure it was secure. And there it was very high-profile security. But I have to say, I could walk through very easily into a very secure area without a single security check. I presume there won't be that kind of mistake made here.
Does the Turkish government have a specific agenda for this NATO summit, particular goals, aims it wants to pursue?
Well, aside from making sure it goes off without a glitch and brings glory to Turkey, yes, I think it does. The Prime Minister here has made it particularly clear that he is keen on what's called the open door policy, on making sure that NATO is a growing organisation rather than a static one. He's pointed particularly to including some of the small Balkan countries who are pushing on NATO's door and making sure they are encouraged and they are told that they will be allowed in. As far as the rest of the NATO agenda is concerned, obviously Turkey is concerned about Iraq, which is its neighbour to the south, and has been an incredibly important country, really, for the last couple of decades for Turkey. It's concerned about Afghanistan. It has troops there. It leads the NATO force there. It's the Turkish commander there. And it's concerned about terrorism, because it has, of course, suffered from terrorism, and it believes that Turkey is an area which is particularly targeted. So all of the kind of hot spots of the NATO summit itself, Turkey is very keenly interested in, with its own angle, but also in a more general sense that it wants to see progress made on them.
Because, of course, strains arose between the United States and Turkey over the Iraq war. Have they been resolved now?
I don't think it's so much a question of resolution of them. I think there's a great deal of bitterness still in some quarters of the American administration. And even speaking with diplomats here, you see them muttering darkly into their coffee about having been betrayed by the Turkish government. And also they've been resolved. It's simply that once again, Turkey has proved its indispensability. You know, after the war, when America seemed utterly triumphant, Turkey looked as if it was absolutely out in the cold. There was no need for it strategically because America would have bases in Iraq. Its role as a bridge between East and West, that much talked about role, seemed to be much less important with American power right in the heart of the Middle East. Well, slowly and not so slowly, it has dawned on people that, in fact, the military position of Turkey is very important. Its contribution to NATO is very important. Its symbolic role as a democratic, secular, Muslim country is also staggeringly important, if not as a model for reform, then perhaps a catalyst among some countries in the region. So in a whole host of ways, Turkey is very much back in there as a player, probably as more of a player than it was before the war.
And will the Turkish government be expecting President Bush to deliver on US pledges to crush Turkish Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq?
That's difficult to read the Turkish government's mind. I mean, certainly whenever they speak publicly about what they have asked the US to do, they talk about this Kurdish paramilitary force, the PKK, that's now renamed itself Kongra Gel, around 5,000 fighters. It wants them crushed. The Americans have said that they will do that. However, America has other things on its mind in Iraq and doesn't really want to open yet another front in the far north of the country. And so I think whilst Kongra Gel is tolerably quiet, Turkey will keep putting pressure on the United States to keep it going. And I think it will want still more lip service paid. I don't think anyone really expects much action yet. The question would be, if Kongra Gel, which has recently lifted a ceasefire, this Kurdish paramilitary group, actually started becoming much more active in southeastern Turkey, just over the northern Iraq border, then would the US act against it aggressively? And I think Turkey would certainly expect it to do so.
Johnny, you talk about Turkey being a bridge between East and West, but overall, which way is it tilting, do you think, at the moment?
Oh, West, certainly. There is one overriding aim of this government in its foreign policy, and that is to join the European Union. It's pursued it with its absolute single-mindedness. Now, of course, it has also made overtures towards various Middle Eastern countries, Syria, Iran. It has made speeches encouraging reform both in the Islamic world and in the Middle East and the Arab world. But really, all its energy is focused on joining the EU now. And I have to say the wind is going rather well in its favour. That doesn't mean it'll be joining anytime soon, but I think we are certainly, Turkey is certainly on the road towards EU membership. Its role as a bridge is more indistinct than simply where it is. I was talking to one analyst recently who said, it's not now about where we are, it's about what we are. Again, a secular, modern, capitalist, tolerably free, tolerably democratic Muslim nation, and they are very, very rare indeed.
Johnny Diamond, many thanks.
Julian, thank you.
And Johnny Diamond is Istanbul correspondent for the BBC. He spoke to us from Istanbul. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. All eyes turn to Turkey next week for the NATO summit in Istanbul. As key allies in the war in Iraq and as a democratic Muslim state in the region, Turkey and its interests have found a good fit with the West and particularly the US, but will that continue? Tonight on Point, the US-Turkey and the future of US-Turkish relations. Is Turkey still in step with the US on Iraq and in the region? What stability might Turkey provide for the region as a political and economic force, as a possible future member of the EU? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington is Sonar Çapti, coordinator of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. Welcome to you.
Hi, Julian.
Also joining us from Chicago is Stephen Kinzer, former Istanbul bureau chief from 1996 to 2000 for the New York Times. He's author of Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds and All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. His article in the July 15th issue of the New York Review of Books is Will Turkey Make It? Mr. Kinzer, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Mr. Çapti, President Bush and the Turkish Prime Minister get on well together. They're both straight-talking, religious-minded conservatives. What else have they got in common?
Well, I think they also have a somehow overlapping vision of the future of the Muslim world in common. They both would like to see change and reform, and it's striking that Turkey's conservative prime minister would be in line with the United States on this, but I think Turkey's prime minister Erdogan sees his party, Justice and Development Party, also known as AKP, as the embodiment or a successful marriage of these ideas of modernity and Islam, because he's saying this party is coming from Turkey's Islamist movement, and yet it is a party that's moving Turkey towards the European Union, and it's a party that's aiming to put Turkey into the Western group of nations where it has always been for the last century. And as a result of that, he sees his party as a successful example of a marriage of Islam and modernity, and he'd like to see the rest of the Muslim world follow that example. Some critics would say that's highly idealistic because Turkey cannot possibly be a model for the rest of the world, but this is nevertheless where his vision overlaps with the vision of the American president for change and reform in the Middle East.
Stephen Kinzer, do you see any forces in Turkey holding back that drift towards the West?
There's a remarkable and I think very broad-based consensus in Turkey that the West is Turkey's future. Actually, this is nothing new. Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the Turkish Republic, always urged Turkey in this direction, and he was even building on forces in the later period of the Ottoman Empire that were also very Western-oriented. Atatürk didn't use the word West. He said that Turkey needed to embrace what he called universal values. Now, Atatürk was very concerned about limiting and restricting the role of religion in Turkish life. What we now see is a fascinating marriage between the Atatürk ideals of Westernization and the conservative Islamic traditions of Anatolia. That's what this new prime minister represents. This is what makes him such a fascinating figure. What he is trying to tell the world, and I think he really has the support of a broad base of the Turkish people, is that there is no clash of civilizations inherent between Islam and the West. I think that the one obstacle that could upset this drive, that could upset this paradigm of an Islamic democratic marriage, is if in December, when the European Union is to vote on whether to begin negotiating with Turkey, it votes no. If that happens, Turks will become very upset and will begin to ask themselves whether perhaps it was true all along what more militant Muslims have said, that there's no point in any Islamic country trying to move towards the West and democratic ideals because the West will always turn it down. That's why the vote in December on European Union membership is so important, for not just for Turkey, but for the entire Islamic world.
Sona Chabtai, do you see it in the same way, that if Turkey is rebuffed by the European Union in December, there could be internal consequences?
Yes, and let me explain why. I think this has got to do with the Turks' relationship to Europe. As Stephen said, Turks have a long history of Europeanization and Westernization going back almost 200 years, and as a result of that, they have now well-developed and deep-rooted Western traditions, from the ideas of freedom of speech and democratic elections to secular government, equality of men and women. But when you look at all of that, I think it's good to realize that this is what the country is about, but there's also another element to it. It's that the Turks have always aspired to join the Western group of nations and Europe. And as a result of that, they have a very interesting, what I call, love and hate relationship with Europe. On the one hand, they really would like to be part of it. They love it. But on the other hand, they would rather not be dependent on it because they always wanted to join it and they want affirmation. So if I think in December the EU's answer is negative, or if it's any sort of an answer that sounds condescending, this is going to bring up the hate element in this Turks' very interesting relationship to Europe, involving both love and at the same time a certain amount of prejudice. So I think, yes, a no answer from the EU, anything that sounds or that smells of condescension is going to create a significant amount of anti-EU backlash, interestingly, in this country, which is very European.
Sona Chabtai, do stay with us, and you too. Stephen Kinzer, we're talking tonight about the US, Turkey and their future. As attention turns to Istanbul for the NATO summit next week, do you see Turkey as a key U.S. ally, even though the Turkish government refused to allow U.S. troops into the country during the Iraq War? Will potential differences be smoothed out or threaten the future of the relationship? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the political and economic climate in Turkey, the state of U.S.-Turkish relations. The Turkish government will host the NATO summit in Istanbul next week, and even in the wake of two bombings yesterday, it says the country is secure. What sway does Turkey hold in the region as a democratic Muslim country? Is Turkey in a position to be the ally that the U.S. expects it to be? Or will other conflicting interests pull the two countries apart? Do you think that President Bush should still be traveling to Turkey for the NATO summit, even as the U.S. State Department warns Americans not to travel there? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Washington is Sonat Çaptay, coordinator of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. Also joining us from Chicago, is Stephen Kinzer, former Istanbul bureau chief from 1996 to 2000 for the New York Times. He's author of Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. His article in the July 15th issue of the New York Review of Books is Will Turkey Make It? Sonat Çaptay, we've been talking about Turkey's aspirations, its desire to join the European Union. Let's turn briefly, though, to relations with the United States. And is Iraq a big sticking point between the two countries?
I think it still is, despite the fact that relations between Turkey and the United States, which sort of hit the rock bottom back in March at the beginning of the war when Turkey refused to help the United States to open up a northern front into Iraq. Despite the fact that relationship has improved significantly since then, I think Iraq is still a sticking point. And what is the sticking point there is what is going to happen to the future of this country. There is some apprehension in Turkey as to whether Iraq will be a failed state with terrorism erupting, in which case, as a neighboring country to Iraq, Turkey will bear the brunt of this failure. But there's also another apprehension, whether Iraq will produce a fundamentalist state in terms of an Islamist fundamentalist government, which is, again, something that will be very unpalatable to many Turks. And third, there's a question of whether there's going to be a Kurdish state in Iraq if Iraq, in fact, dissolves into many entities. And that would be something unfavorable in Turkey, I think largely because of not so much of the Turks, whether or not they're concerned with the emergence of a Kurdish state, but because of the fact that this Kurdish state that would emerge would have a significant presence of a very large terrorist group operating within it, the PKK, which you touched on earlier, that's currently based along the Turkish-Iraqi border in northern Iraq. And I think so long as the PKK remains in that area, any movement towards the emergence of a Kurdish state is going to create a huge amount of apprehension in Turkey.
Stephen Kinzer, the United States would like to see a strong Kurdish entity in northern Iraq, and yet by doing so, it risks, does it not, antagonizing the Turkish government?
The Turks are very fearful of the emergence of a strong Kurdish entity or a quasi-state in northern Iraq. Nonetheless, it's possible, I think, that some accommodation could be made. As you just heard, if the Turks could be convinced that a Kurdish entity in what is now northern Iraq would not be hostile to Turkey and, in fact, would crack down on terrorists trying to operate within that entity with the aim of subverting Turkey, I think they might be calmed down. They haven't seen any of that yet. Not only have they been frustrated that the United States has not moved against anti-Turkish Kurdish groups that are operating in northern Iraq, but they are very fearful about a new development in that region, which is the presence of Israel up there. The Israelis, who see Iran and the Shiite community in the Middle East as perhaps their greatest long-term security threat, are moving security and intelligence agents into northern Iraq. What they're doing there is they're training Kurdish commando groups in tactics that would allow them to infiltrate into Arab areas of Iraq, identify leaders of the Iraqi insurgency, kill them, and cripple their operations. The Turks are terrified by this because they fear that these same Israeli-trained Kurdish commandos will, at some later date, use their skills to attack Turkey or to train other Kurds who will attack Turkey. This is a great long-term fear for Turkey, and that's why developments in northern Iraq are so important to relations between the United States and the West in general and Turkey.
Okay, let's take a call from Zare in Belmont, Massachusetts. Zare, what did you want to say?
First, I want to thank you for all this beautiful discussion. I think I believe that Turkey, just like all the other people in the European and the bordering areas, should have eventually should be able to join the European Union. But Turkey still has documented human rights and historic issues. Unless they respect those and correct them, like such as the denial of Armenian genocide, still they rewrite history, deny atrocities and genocide, as well as, of course, their treatment of the Kurdish, whether they have rightful fears of future issues with Kurds, etc. But we all must recognize 12 to 15 million Kurds in eastern Turkey. Eventually, they have their own rights for national identity, culture, etc. Just because they are there and they are a threat to Turkey, Turkey cannot just treat them as second-class citizens and then expect to be joining the European Union.
A brief response from Sona Chaptai to that.
Sure. Good point. I think what I heard probably reminds me of Turkey 20 years ago, but not the Turkey that I know now. I think this country has gone through a tremendous reform and transition over the past two decades, largely over the last few years also, as a result of this drive towards EU accession. Now, the EU has very simple criteria when it wants to admit members, and the criteria basically says countries have to have rule of law, institutions guaranteeing democracy, and protection of minorities. And I think if you look at Turkey's record, it satisfies each and every one of these criteria. Whether the cultural rights that have been given to the Kurds, I think there is no denial of cultural rights of the Kurds right now. There's Kurdish language broadcasting. There's Kurdish language education. The fact that the country's military, which for a long time was had a significant role in running the political system, is now strictly out of the game as a result of the reform process. And we have seen that happen over the past few years. Turkey does unconditionally, I think, satisfy, if you look at it from the perspective of the European Union, the EU's accession rules, the so-called Copenhagen criteria, which doesn't mean that this is a country with a perfect record on everything. I think just like any other country, you could always look at Turkey and find things that are missing. But I think that applies also to many other countries that are joining the EU or that have joined the EU in the past. I can think of countries in Eastern Europe which have significant issues with minorities, from the Roma, the Gypsy in Slovakia, to the Russian speakers in Latvia. There are 20% of Latvia's population are Russian speakers, and they're not citizens. And Latvia is a member to the EU. Doesn't mean Latvia should not get in. I think it's good that it's getting in, because it's going to be able to resolve these problems with minority issues because of this drive towards the EU, which says countries have to have better record in terms of their democratic rule and treatment of minorities.
Sona Chaptai, I'd just like to bring another voice into the conversation, Genghis Chandar. He's CNN Turk political analyst and a political affairs columnist with Sabah, a leading newspaper in Istanbul. He joins us now from Istanbul, where it's very early in the morning. Welcome, Genghis Chandar, and thanks very much for being with us at what is this very early hour for you. What do you reckon has been the human rights record of the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan since he came to office?
Well, it improved a lot. Of course, that's not perfect, but as Sona Chaptai was saying, the overall record of Turkey's human rights have been improved a lot, and it does not constitute any obstacle for Turkey's bid for the EU in terms of meeting the Copenhagen political criteria. And so the Tayyip Erdogan government and the public opinion in general are very hopeful.
And has that improvement come about? Has that improvement come about because Turkey so much wants to join the European Union, or do you think that this current government has democratic instincts?
Well, I think these are interrelated. This government has democratic instincts because this government, including the Prime Minister himself, has been subjected to human rights violations earlier. The Prime Minister served prison terms, and so when he got to form the government, aware of his own background, that he was keen to improve the Turkish human rights record, and for that the EU to set Turkey on the EU track would provide guarantees for the survival of the government, for the improvement of the human rights situation in Turkey, and in order to meet the Copenhagen criteria, in order to get Turkey in the EU, the government had to do some reforms, and they are doing it. So it's an interrelated case.
Genghis Chandar, CNN Turk political analyst. Many thanks for joining us there in the early hours of the morning in Istanbul, in Turkey. Stephen Kinzer, if I could just come back to you. At the end of your New York Review of Books article, you posed the question to Prime Minister Erdogan. How does he respond to the widespread fear that he's not the reformer he seems to be, but rather an Islamist in secular disguise?
This is the great question that I think many Turks are still debating. There's no real debate in Turkey over Erdogan's agenda. The great majority of Turks support his drive towards Europe and westernization. The one debate that is still raging in Turkey, and it's particularly strong among secularists and traditional, what we call Kemalists, people who support the Ataturk modernizing ideology, is this. Does this political leader, does Prime Minister Erdogan, who comes out of an Islamic political background, have some kind of hidden agenda? Does he really want westernization and democratic freedoms only for their own sake? Or does he perhaps feel that by bringing Turkey into the EU, he can push the military aside, the military being the greatest defender of secularism in Turkey, and then proceed with a hidden agenda of Islamizing Turkish society or making it more religious and conservative? Now, his answer to me was, just look at what I'm doing. There is nothing in my program, in my record, that supports those charges. And certainly in what he has done over the last year and a half that he's been in power supports that. Nonetheless, the fact that this prime minister comes out of an Islamic political background is, on the one hand, a tremendous asset because it helps him project to the Muslim world that there really is no conflict for a person who prays every day and whose wife covers her head with a scarf to be a Democrat and oriented toward the West. On the other hand, that background leads many secular Turks to be suspicious, and they're still waiting very suspiciously to see whether Erdogan has some other agenda. This is something he firmly denies, but other people are still waiting to see.
Stephen Kinzer, thanks for that. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. And let's take a call from Chuck in Boston, Massachusetts. Chuck.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. And what would you like to ask?
Well, I have a concern, and my concern is here. One main issue with the Iraqi war, we weren't allowed by the Turkish government to move our troops and open up that second northern front. And it concerns me because they are a NATO member, and the amount of funds we give them on a yearly basis to subsidize their military. It seems to me at this point that we're trying to appease them just for a strategic position of where Turkey is situated within the Middle East. But what is going to happen later if we require further assistance to open up yet another front, wherever it may be? And we can't just discard the Kurdish situation, because at that point they stood by us during this situation in northern Iraq. So it is a balanced situation, but I don't think we should just blindly appease the Turkish government, because right now the last caller brought up something interesting, that the answer was, you know, for the past 20 years Turkey has changed. But if Turkey has changed in the past 20 years, then why didn't they allow their largest funder from monies to go through their country and save a lot of American lives? I think we're just appeasing something temporarily that could, in the long term, cause more American dollars, more American lives to be lost.
Sonia Chabtai, I suppose the answer to that is widespread anti-American sentiment in Turkey at the time.
Well, yes, and I think the question answered itself. The fact that Turkey changed so much over the last 20 years explains why it did not allow, as the question said, a funder to use its territory to wage a war, because Turkey has a parliament which voted, had a discussion in its free press, and there was overwhelming resistance to the idea of a war, and the parliament said no. This was not a NATO operation, so Turkey was not bound by the NATO charter to join the operation. And I think the amount of aid Turkey gets from the United States is significant, but it's only in the range of a few $100 million, so it's not that of a big deal. Of course, what makes the question right now is Turkey still important? People may say, why do we have to keep appeasing this country? and look at the Kurds. They have stood with us. I think the Kurds have done a great job in the war, but there's also the fact that they do not represent our major constituency in Iraq. They're only about 15 to 20% of Iraq's population. So far, we have done a good job of satisfying them, but that means that we have alienated the majority of Iraq's population. It's Arab majority, especially the Shiites, who think that the Kurds have gotten too much in the bargaining process in terms of gaining a minority blocking vote on many of Iraq's constitutional processes. So as a result of that, I was in Iraq recently a few months ago, and one of the things I heard was a great amount of resentment among the majority Shiites towards what they thought was the Kurds being treated favorably by us. And I think as a result of that, now we're seeing a more balanced treatment of Iraq's many constituencies, including the Kurds and the Arabs. And that also brings the Turkey into the picture. The question that Turkey did not allow the war, I think, is something that is now part of the past. The question is, why is Turkey still important? Turkey, I think, matters. And I think why it matters is because this is, in the post-9/11 environment, as a secular, democratic, overwhelmingly Muslim country, Turkey is proof that it can be done, that Muslim countries can be secular and democratic if they strive, if they work towards it. So Turkey is symbolically important. And moreover, it's proof that, you know, in this day and age, when we're all asking questions about Islam and what it means and if it's full of hatred towards the Western world, Turkey is proof that Islam is not inherently problematic.
Let me just
ask. It is Muslim
ask...
societies that are not secular or democratic that are problematic. Okay. So I think that's why Turkey's success is important to us.
Let me just get a very, very brief response from Stephen Kinzert of the thought that Turkey really a reliable United States ally when, as Chuck pointed out, they were not there for the United States in its hour of need during the Iraq War? Very briefly.
Turkey has been supporting the United States in every operation it undertook ever since the Korean War. I think you could argue that in this case, the Turks were trying to tell the Americans, what you're doing is not in your own national interest. We can see it because we're living here. They were trying to wake up the Americans to something that I think Americans are only now beginning to understand.
Stephen Kinzer, stay with us. You too, Sona Chabtai. We're talking about Turkey and the future of U.S.-Turkish relations. Do you see Turkey successfully balancing political and religious interests or sacrificing one for the other? And is it in the United States' best interest to keep Turkey as a close ally in the region? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Turkey, its role as a model for democracy in the Muslim world, its identity crisis of being pulled between East and West. When you see Turkey being tugged between secularism and religious fundamentalism, what would you like the outcome to be? Should admittance to the EU be at the top of the Turkish government's agenda? Is embracing Western ideals the best, the only way forward? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Washington, Sona Chabtai, coordinator of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute, and from Chicago, Stephen Kinzer, from Istanbul bureau chief from 1996 to 2000 for the New York Times. He's author of Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. Sona Chabtai, can I just inject a little controversy into the debate? We've been talking about the exercise of democracy in Turkey, the way in which it was Parliament that blocked the access of U.S. troops into northern Iraq. But isn't the reality in Turkey that all decisions finally are taken by the military?
Not anymore. That may have been the case once upon a time, but I think since the cessation of the fight by the terrorist Kurdish group PKK, I think the military has significantly withdrawn from the public and political sphere. And to answer your question, I think the best example of what has happened in Turkey and how the decisions are now made through the government and the press and the media and the opposition parties, but not through the government, is what has happened in Turkey over the past 6 months when the country discussed the resolution of the Cyprus issue. which was seen as in relation to Turkey's getting into the EU. The debate in Turkey was driven entirely by the government, the opposition, the media, and the NGOs. The military was absent from the debate at any given stage. And I think this is the ultimate proof that this is not a country where the military is the kingmaker. That's not the case anymore.
Okay. Let's take a call from Herman in Concord, Massachusetts. And he wants to mention the O word, oil.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm wondering in our relationship with Turkey, how much big oil and big business has to do with our desire to have them as friends, particularly with the new plans for the oil pipeline coming from the Caspian to the Mediterranean. And I ask that wondering really why Europe is such a reluctant partner in accepting Turkey in as a member, and why U.S. is so keen on getting Turkey into the membership.
That's one for you, I think, Stephen Kinzer.
Well, you're touching on two different issues. The oil issue first is one that is probably less important in Turkey than it is in many other countries in the Middle East, including Iraq. Turkey, of course, is not an oil-producing state. The United States has been anxious to build a pipeline that would bring Caspian oil out through Turkey because the alternatives were bringing it out through Afghanistan or bringing it out through Iran. But the greater issue here is whether Turkey can provide a stabilizing force that will allow the United States to look somewhat beyond its obsession with resources in the Middle East. Turkey's message to the American government has been, listen, we live here. We are going to be a neighbor of Iraq forever. You will go one day. One day your attention will turn somewhere else. Our attention cannot turn anywhere else because we live here. And the Turks, of course, being the heir of the greatest Muslim empire of all time, the Ottoman Empire, feel themselves very much on an equal level with the Americans and the Europeans. The Americans and the Europeans don't see it that way, of course. Europe has a very peculiar and special relationship with and attitude toward Turkey. And that's based on several reasons. First of all, of course, Ottoman armies, Turkish armies, were fighting European armies for centuries. The Ottoman army was besieging Vienna just a few hundred years ago. For a long time, the dominant question in Europe was not whether Catholicism or Protestantism would prevail, but whether the Turks would take Paris and overrun all of Europe and impose Islam on it. So the Turks have a psychological place in the European imagination. More recently, several million Turks from very poor Anatolian villages during the 1960s and 70s moved to European cities at the invitation of Europeans to work in European factories. They actually fueled the German and West European economic boom of the post-war era. And when Europeans looked out their window in Cologne and in Hamburg and in Brussels, they saw very poor, very backward, very inward-looking Turks. These immigrants, these laborers, formed the stereotype in the European mind of what the modern Turk is. And I can tell you from my experience of living in Turkey that it drives the educated Turks crazy to realize that these poor, backward Turks from eastern Anatolian villages, who would be completely lost in Ankara or Istanbul, are now, in their role as citizens of Europe or residents of European cities, forming the image of what Turkey means. So the European idea of what the Turk means is something very deeply rooted in psychology and history, and that's something that both Europe and Turkey now have to confront.
Stephen Kinzer, thanks for that. Let's take a call from Ibrahim in Boston, Massachusetts. He's a Turkish citizen and wants to reflect more on the future than the past. Ibrahim?
Good evening, gentlemen.
And good evening to you, too. What would you like to say?
I have a question, and I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Kinzer. My question is, do you think that there would be a different response from Turkey if there was a democratic president? Or do you think that if the democratic diplomacy was in use at the moment, there would be a different Turkish response from to use of the using of Turkish soil to get into the northern Iraq or the military questions? This is my question.
Stephen Kinzer, very briefly, would a change of administration in Washington affect U.S.-Turkish relations?
I don't think the Turks or the Turkish government are focused so intently on whether a Republican or a Democrat occupies the presidency of the United States. The big difference in the way Turks perceive their role in the world and the way Americans and Europeans perceive Turkey's role in the world is this. The Turks think of themselves as heirs to a great empire, very self-confident. They have a great role in the world, whereas Europeans and Americans think of Turkey as one of 100 little third-world countries that are out there that they have to deal with. Turks don't think of themselves that way at all.
Sonar Çebtay, could I just move on now and talk about Turkey as a model for the rest of the Islamic world, if indeed Turkey includes itself as being part of the Islamic world, and the example there of being able to combine Islam and democracy. Your thoughts on that?
I think that's a great question. The fact that this is a country with an overwhelming Muslim population, that has deep-rooted Western traditions, a secular political system, democratic elections, a free market economy, and a tradition of Westernization going back a few hundred years, equality of men and women, and now pursuant to the recent reforms, many, many liberties. This is an interesting debate because in this day and age, when you look around the Muslim world, there are about 56 countries whose populations are overwhelmingly Muslim. Not a single one is like Turkey. And I think the question is, what does that mean for the rest of the Muslim world? I think it means one thing, that Turkey can be not perhaps a model because it is significantly different from most other countries in its neighborhood, especially the Arab Middle East, in terms of the fact that it has its own understanding of Islam, a more spiritual, less rigid interpretation of this religion based on the Sufi traditions, the fact that its own unique history that Stephen Kinzer identified, the Ottoman Empire, the fact that it has deep-rooted Western political traditions. It's very different from its neighborhood, but it still means something. That Turkey is inspiration, that if other countries would like to pursue the same path, this is achievable. But there's another thing that Turkey is significant for, and it's that there are no shortcuts to where Turkey is. This cannot be done overnight. That's why I think people who are hopeful that Iraq would overnight turn into a secular Western democracy should look at Turkey and learn from the Turkish experience. The Turkish experience encompasses many decades. It's 60 years of multi-party democracy, 80 years of secularism, and more than 200 years of Westernization. So unfortunately, there are no shortcuts to where the country is, but it's example and it's an inspiration, and that's how we should treat it for the rest of the Muslim world. And that's why I think Turkey is important, because it's symbolically significant.
Sonar Çebtay, thanks for that. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. And let's take a call from David in Worcester, Massachusetts. And David, I think you want to go down that same route.
Yes. I agree with he answered the last just answer some of my questions, the comment I want to say. But I want to tell you, because your guests always say Turkey is an Islamic country. They are Islamic country by name. Any Islamic country, if the government does not run the Sharia law, it does not consider as Islamic country. What I mean Sharia, it doesn't want I mean like the Taliban they used to do. That's completely off the wall, you know. But what I'm saying, if the government of a country, Islamic country, does not apply the Sharia law, it's not does not consider as Islamic country. This is one point. Second point, like the guest said, Turk, they are not Arab. And actually, the Turk has a name for the Arab. They hate the Arab. They don't want to be associated with the Arab. That's what actually well, they want to move to Europe. It's not because they want to be a model for the Arab country as an Islamic country. That's the second point. The third point, you say democratic country. I don't think it's a democratic country because if you look at the Christian in their country, I mean, look and ask any Christian, Turk Christian, he will tell you they are not treated well. But if you consider Lebanon as another country, as a part, because we have a lot in Lebanon, there is a lot of Christian, they are actually more democratic in Lebanon than the Turks. But I don't see anybody discuss that situation because it does not, United States doesn't have no strategic interest in that region, and that's why they focus in Turkey, because Turkey is not Arabic country. They
okay.
know...
Let's get a response to that from Stephen Kinzer, to that idea that you can hardly regard Turkey as a model for the rest of the Islamic world because Turkey is not an Arab country.
Well, of course, most of the Islamic countries in the world are not Arab either. It's certainly true that Turks and Arabs have had a difficult relationship over history. Nonetheless, I believe that most of the people that are living in the Arab world are desperately looking for some new paradigm, some way out of the prison that they found themselves in over these last decades. Turkey is not trying to impose itself on Arab countries. Nonetheless, if the West shows that it can embrace Turkey, then I think we'll see something that contradicts what your caller said. Your caller said, as I understood it, that Turkey really does not impose Sharia law, cannot be considered a truly Islamic country. Now, Prime Minister Erdogan repeatedly says, this is one of his favorite lines, we do not want to be an Islamic democracy. We are a democracy, no adjectives, in a country that is predominantly Muslim. There is no Islamic democracy. There's no special form of democracy for Islamic countries. There's one kind of democracy, and it can take hold in countries where the majority of the population is Muslim, just like it can take hold in populations in countries where populations have other religions.
Sonu Çaptay, let's just return to that prospect of Turkey possibly being granted accession to the European Union, or at least to begin negotiations at the end of this year. Would that, do you think, consolidate democracy within Turkey?
Significantly so, I think, because it would only give the Turks the right message that in their centuries-old aspirations to join Europe and adopt European ideas and traditions, Europe is finally affirming that, and I think it would be a passageway for Turkey to become into a consolidated democratic regime. And I think in this regard, what is important is that the Turks' relationship with the West, as your caller said earlier, is different than the relationship that other people in the Middle East have. It's not that the Turks hate Arabs. It's that the Turks do not hate the West. And I think in most of the rest of the Middle East, you find that, including the Arabs, the rest of the population has a certain dislike and deep hatred towards the West. And this is, I think, what makes the Turks different than the rest of the Middle East. They have no problems joining the European Union or borrowing European institutions or being at peace with the Western world, because as Stephen Kinzer identified earlier, the Turks see themselves on par with Europe. They've never colonized by it. They see themselves as equals with Europe. As a result of that, they're not full of hatred towards Europe. And I think that's what distinguishes Turkey most in this day and age, when hatred towards the West is brewing in most of the rest of the Muslim countries.
Sonu Çaptay, thanks for being with us. Sonu Çaptay, coordinator of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. Our thanks to you too, Stephen Kinzer, joining us there from Chicago. Stephen Kinzer, former Istanbul bureau chief from 1996 to 2000 for the New York Times. He's author of Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. His article in the July 15th issue of the New York Review of Books is Will Turkey Make It? Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point.